this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, People to Watch, Special Feature, 10 Local Execs Ready to Transform Area's Business Landscape. And that's the headline on the cover. Inside, there's another headline starting it off. 2017 People to Watch. Triangle Business Journal profiles 10 people expected to make an impact on the Triangle in the year ahead. So what's coming in 2017? Change, probably growth, and some fascinating stories on the business front as the Triangle's remarkable economic engine surges into a new year. The staff at Triangle Business Journal reviewed what happened in 2016 and peered ahead to discern the entrepreneurs and leaders we expect to make a major difference in the market in 2017. Here's our look at the people we will be watching in 2017, and you should be too. It's a group that includes youth, experience, and a dose of panache. These are men and women who will make and guide some major decisions ahead. And this was written by Dane Huffman. Tatiana Bergeson, Matty Energy. For Tatiana Bergeson and her energy drink company, Matty Energy, 2016 opened the door for scalability. The year started by capitalizing on a strategy that would cut costs and boost production, an in-house manufacturing facility in Clayton. Ahead of the opening, Bergeson predicted the company would save 20% on its cost of goods. And not only would new equipment mean more efficient canning, but the ability to pasteurize gives the product a longer shelf life, handy when expanding distribution deals and online sales. This decision came with us realizing we wanted more control over the finished product, she said of the expanded operation. Although Bergeson has cited fundraising as the biggest challenge facing local entrepreneurs for 2016, she seems to be mastering her pitch. By mid-August, she closed on two separate rounds of funding for the year, a total of just more than $3 million. She already counts AOL co-founder Steve Case and entrepreneurial activist Lauren Whitehurst as an investor and mentor, respectively. Production hasn't been the only area of growth for Maddie. With the money she raised, Bergeson has increased the company's headcount. Maddie started the year with only a few employees, but by third quarter 2016, the company grew to about 15. Her efforts have been noticed. Bergeson was named one of Inc. magazine's 30 Under 30 winners in May. I'm incredibly honored, and it's a huge testament to the long hours my growing team has been putting in, she said. I'm proud and excited. Maddie also made its debut on Triangle Business Journal's Best Places to Work list in 2016. Maddie has come a long way. From its humble beginnings in a Duke University dorm room in 2012, it's now one of the most popular energy drinks sold in stores in the Southeast. And it looks like the energy boost is going to continue in 2017. That was written by Mark DeRoberts. Ari Boostbib, IMS Health, Quintiles IMS. Following Quintiles' merger with IMS Health, which closed in October, it seems clear that decisions about the future of Quintiles IMS will be coming from Danbury, Connecticut, and many from the desk of Ari Boostbib. The company says it will maintain dual headquarters in Durham and Connecticut, but its new chairman and chief executive officer, Boostbib, is Legacy IMS. IMS recruited Boostbib, a native of France who got his MBA at Columbia University, in 2010 from United Technologies Corporation. He had risen quickly at UTC and moved to IMS as chief executive officer. 4 years later, Boostbib led IMS in its initial public offering, which ultimately raised $1.3 billion. Further south, however, Boostbib's name was unfamiliar. That changed when homegrown Quintiles announced in a surprise move in May that it would be acquired by the slightly smaller IMS. Boostbib was tapped to lead the combined company, with Quintiles CEO Tom Pike taking a new position as vice chairman and president of Quintiles IMS's Research and Development Solutions business unit. Following the merger's closing, Quintiles has made a couple of big announcements that may have local implications with Boostbib at the helm. On Quintiles IMS's third quarter earnings call in November, Boostbib said the company had identified an additional $100 million in cost synergies from the merger, expected to be realized by 2019. He said those savings would be derived from duplicate infrastructure and back office functions, including areas of overlap such as information technology, human resources, and the company's global delivery network. The following month, the company announced that Pike, who joined Quintiles in 2012, succeeding founder Dennis Gillings at the helm, would retire abruptly. While it's not clear what additional changes are ahead for Quintiles IMS, it is clear Boostbib will indeed be leading them. Written by Jennifer Henderson. Dale Folwell, North Carolina State Treasurer. Dale Folwell, a Republican from Winston-Salem, is proud of his humble beginnings and quite aware of what a budget crunch can mean. Now he is eager to put his passion for numbers and blue-collar ethic to work as North Carolina's state treasurer at a time when he believes the state must act to avoid future shortages. The next state treasurer is going to make a generational difference in North Carolina's future, Folwell said. Growing up, Folwell was determined to become an accountant. Despite modest means, he pushed his way into the professional ranks by earning money as a trash collector and custodian, among other jobs, to pay for his education at UNC Greensboro. I was poor in resource, Folwell likes to say, but rich in opportunity. Now he takes over as treasurer after beating Democrat Dan Blue III of Raleigh in the November election. Folwell received 2,373,022 votes and Blue 2,129,762. He will replace Democrat Janet Cowell, who did not seek re-election. The treasurer's role can be one that is low profile and high impact. Folwell barrels into the job after raising alarms about the state of North Carolina's finances. The treasurer has a multitude of roles, including managing the state's pension fund, valued at $89.8 billion as of September 30. To put that in perspective, the state's overall budget is right at $22 billion. On the pension, the state assumes a 7.25% long-term rate of return, but the actual rate can vary. The state reported that the fund gained 3.5% for the third quarter and 8.4% over the previous 12 months. Despite the whopping size of the pension fund, Folwell worries that the state's obligations will outpace its funds. What I've told people is we have a pension plan that is assuming it will grow at 7.25%, Folwell said. It has not done that. He especially wants to take a look at management fees. The first thing I want to do is find out where the money is, how well it's doing, who is managing it, and how much they get paid to manage it, Folwell said. So the first goal is to drive down these management fees by at least $100 million. The treasurer also chairs the board of the state health plan, which offers coverage to more than 700,000 people. The treasurer is responsible for managing that cost, making sure the plan fits the needs of state employees. Those health care costs are an intense concern, too, as he takes over. And it's unlike the pension. We have made promises for lifetime health care benefits, and no money was ever set aside for that purpose, he said. The key, Folwell said, is to get younger, healthier state employees involved in the plan. And managing the pension and health care obligations, he says, will be essential for the state to retain its AAA bond rating. And that was written by Dane Huffman. Niall Handley, Raleigh Beer Garden, Solas, Hibernian, Soco Mexican Grill, The Station at Person Street. And this is written by Amanda Hoyle. Over the past decade, Niall Handley was becoming one of the leading forces for growth in the restaurant and bar scene in downtown Raleigh, breaking world records and helping pump new money into old parts of town. And he hasn't run out of new ideas yet. In the spring, Handley, owner of the Raleigh Beer Garden, Solas Nightclub, Hibernian Pub, Zoco Mexican Grill, and The Station Restaurant, plans to debut one of his most innovative endeavors yet, the Morgan Street Food Hall and Market in Raleigh's burgeoning warehouse district. The Morgan Street Food Hall and Market is slated to be a 22,000-square-foot multi-vendor food concourse where both budding and established chefs, bakers, and food makers can rent spaces to test their craft and reach new customers. Modeled after the popular Central Food Hall at Atlanta's Ponce City Market and the Chelsea Market in Manhattan's Meatpacking District, Handley says it's the next big thing for Raleigh's food scene. It's not a new concept. I'm not a trailblazer, but there's nothing like this here, Hanley says, explaining that the kitchens and kiosks inside the Fool Hall will have all the plumbing, electrical, walk-in cooler, and counter spaces installed, plus a shared seating area for diners and a full-service bar. The tenant has to only bring in their equipment, so upfit costs are zero, he says. Cross-meal ordering among the different eateries and restaurants will be encouraged. Hanley says that in other cities where this idea has been tried, the food halls have become destinations for locals and tourists alike. This is an incubator where chefs can develop their talent. The hope is they're really able to practice their craft and give them an opportunity to get into the business, he says. On the other side of downtown Raleigh, Hanley and a business partner expect to open the new Watts & Ward Underground Bar at the corner of Blount and Hargett Streets in January. The 6,000-square-foot multi-room space will be accessible from a stairwell next to the Cafe Luna restaurant. I really like the space, and we're very happy with it, Hanley says. The immigrant from Ireland is also pursuing plans to expand his world-record-setting Raleigh Beer Garden concept into Charlotte and is establishing a plan to franchise the concept into other parts of the U.S. The Raleigh Beer Garden on Glenwood Avenue generated attention from around the globe after it opened in mid-2015, with 378 individual taps of draft beer selections, a new record verified by Guinness World Records for having the most varieties of beer on draft tap in the world. Hanley says he's close to signing a lease to open a Charlotte Beer Garden in the Queen City in 2017 or early 2018, but he won't disclose yet where it will be located. As for the franchise plan, he says the lawyers are finishing up the necessary paperwork. And the next person to watch, written by Amanda Hoyle, is actually Leon Capital Group. In 2014, Leon Capital Group purchased one of its first properties in North Carolina, paying $6 million for a Barnes & Noble bookstore building in Cary. The deal was the Dallas firm's first investment in the Triangle's real estate market, and it would start a series of events that has put the Triangle and other North Carolina metro regions square in the crosshairs of attention from Leon Capital Group's acquisition and commercial development partners. Leon Capital Group, founded in 2002 by South Texas native Fernando De Leon, has amassed a real estate portfolio of $2.5 billion in assets, mostly centered in Texas and Florida, and with a scattering of assets in Mexico, as well as California, Oklahoma, and several other states. In 2016, though, Leon Capital Group paid close to $21 million to acquire land in Raleigh and in Chapel Hill for a multitude of new retail and multifamily development projects, including the proposed Wegmans grocery store in Chapel Hill. Sources say the firm still has a few more projects pending, with land under contract to buy in Cary and other parts of the Triangle for additional retail and multifamily development projects. We look at job growth and stable drivers of economy when we look at what markets we want to invest in, and it doesn't have to be in major MSAs like a lot of other REITs have to do, says Triangle real estate veteran Todd Harrelson, who was hired by Leon Capital Group in 2014 to establish an office in North Carolina. Harrelson has focused on finding new retail development opportunities in both Carolinas. The firm also recently hired Brian Nicholson in Charlotte to expand its multifamily development efforts in the Carolinas. We like to identify underserved markets where we can create some value, Harrelson says. We are a much more opportunistic investor and developer. The focus on North Carolina came, Harrelson says, after De Leon brought in a young Jesus Areza in 2012 as Leon Capital Group's Managing Director of Retail Acquisitions and Development. Areza had double majored in economics and public policy while a student at Duke University in the early 2000s, hence bringing a familiarity of the Triangle region. Harrelson says Leon Capital Group is also working on North Carolina projects identified in Wilmington, Charlotte, and Asheville, including a 25-acre mixed-use community called Steel Creek Crossing near Charlotte Premium Outlets Mall. Leon Capital Group's known projects that are already on the drawing boards in the Triangle for 2017 and beyond include the $30 million redevelopment of the soon-to-be-vacated Performance Auto Mall dealership site in Chapel Hill into a 120,000-square-foot Wegmans grocery store and market, development of the former Crown Honda Volvo Auto dealership site on the Fordham Boulevard Service Road in Chapel Hill into a multifamily apartment project with a five-story and a four-story apartment building with an interior parking deck. Development of an 18-acre land assemblage along Maiden Lane near Hillsborough Street and Oberlin Road in Raleigh, with plans to build an apartment community called Hillstone Cameron Village that will have 201 total units. Development of the 237-unit Hillstone at Alston Town Center multifamily project on NC 55 in Cary. And future development of a 13.8-acre site at the northeast corner of Six Forks and Strickland Roads in North Raleigh that was purchased in June 2016 for $3 million. Brendan Morrissey, NetCertiv. NetCertiv Chief Executive Officer and co-founder Brendan Morrissey is staying mum about what could be next for his company. That's as Morrisville-based NetCertiv's competitors in the digital marketing software space, from Reach Local to Yodel, have announced buyouts. I think you're sort of always thinking about an exit on some level, but mostly it's critical that you just build a nice, sustainable business that's built to last, he said in a recent interview. That, ironically enough, does open up exit opportunities. As does investor pressure. The company has raised more than $62 million over the past 6 years from players such as Babson Capital Management, Graycroft Partners, and River Cities Capital Funds. While Morrissey is not publicly talking exit, he is publicly talking growth. His company, a fixture on Triangle Business Journal's Fast 50 list, has about 250 employees. That's more than the 100 hired over the past 2 years alone. It's a big uptick from the handful of founders who started the firm in spring 2009 when Morrissey was fresh off serving as vice president of business development at Motor City. NetCertiv doesn't release its finances, though its Inc. 5000 profile lists its annual revenue at about $45 million. But it did recently disclose 400% revenue growth over the past 3 years, possibly fueled by a recent $24 million fundraise. The stakes in what NetCertiv is trying to do are high. A recent report released by NetCertiv and Burrell Associates shows a large amount of brand-funded co-op marketing funds, about $14 billion, goes unredeemed by local businesses due to complicated rules and a lack of digital focus. And that's the top-dollar problem NetCertiv aims to solve for brands such as Xerox and Serta. It's investing in technologies intended to help brands and their networks unlock that funding and leverage it in local markets. With a network of clients from several sectors, from automotive to major appliance to furniture, it can deliver an industry-specific local campaign at scale. And that was written by Lauren Onasorge. And next we have Kate Pierce of the City of Raleigh. This is written by Cameron Snipes. Back in January 2015, officials announced the City of Raleigh would purchase the 308-acre Dorothea Dix campus for $52 million. The announcement and the subsequent closing of the deal in July of that year was the culmination of a decade of ongoing negotiations between the city and the state after the decision to close Dix Hospital in Raleigh and build a new mental health hospital in Butner. Some big-name executives in the area put their influence behind closing the deal and creating a vision for a new city-owned park. But here's a name you may not have heard of, and it's the one who will guide city leaders in implementing the Dix vision, Kate Pierce. A senior planner with the City of Raleigh, Pierce was hired a year ago to manage the day-to-day functions of the implementation process for the new park. She's charged with leading the effort to build the internal infrastructure needed to turn plans and visions into reality. The city's plan is to turn the Dix campus into Raleigh's own version of Central Park, but planning details were on hold until the state and the city could iron out the transaction. The city is now in the process of initiating a master planning process for the park in 2017. It's everything from porta-potties to the full implementation of the vision of the park, Pierce says of her job responsibilities. The operation is still in the vetting stage of the consultant selection process. That process began several months ago and started with 18 teams of consultants, each consisting mainly of landscape architects and complementary service professionals. The field was narrowed down to 4. Final interviews with those teams will be held in February, Pierce says. She will work closely and directly with the selected consulting team, which will execute the vision of City Council, the Dix Executive Committee, the Dix Conservancy, and the people of Raleigh. The conversion of the park will take approximately 1.5 to 2 years and will implement various ideas from the community and be respectful of the history of the land, Pierce says. 2017 will be a time when we really start to think about the future of the park, she says. It'll be a critical time to bring the community together and think big time and boldly about that future. And next we have Jim Triandafloo of Relias Learning. Jim Triandafloo is about to lead Cary-based Relias Learning into its next mega-growth round in 2017. The Relias name is new, although the company has been around since 2002. Triandafloo has steered it through some of its biggest changes and milestones since he arrived as chief executive officer in 2012. Relias's growth has come from being acquired and acquiring other companies that mesh well with its online education platform that focuses on the healthcare industry. When Triandafloo started in Cary, there were 15 employees in the local office. In 2014, Bertelsmann bought the company from Vista Capital for $540 million. Relias now employs more than 400 locally. Over the summer, Relias announced a massive expansion that involves creating 450 new jobs over the next several years. If it fulfills its hiring pledge, Relias will receive up to $5.3 million over the next 12 years through the state's Job Development Investment Grant Program. Next year, our plan is to hire a net of 200 more people, Triandafloo said. Literally every single department in the company has openings. But Triandafloo and his team aren't looking to fill seats to avoid clawbacks of the state's JDIG funds. Asked in a recent interview about Relias's biggest challenge, he said, hiring great people. Last year we hired under 2% of all the people who applied. Rather than outsourcing, recruiting, and training, we've tried to make it a core competency. We have 6 in-house recruiters and 4 in-house trainers. Relias's growth strategy was given a boost this fall by its acquisition of 2 companies that allowed it to enter the acute care market. That's significant because Triandafloo points to the fact that 95% of its business is in senior care and behavioral health markets. Entering the acute care market is an important step toward training healthcare workers in all care settings, he said. 1/3 of healthcare workers work in acute care settings. While the stage appears to be set for Relias to successfully execute its growth plans, the question that remains is, where? Its current building at Crossroads 3 on Corning Road in Cary only has about 5% vacancy as of third quarter 2016. The company had said it would work to expand as best as it could in the building, where its lease agreement runs for about another 3 years, until it has to consider other options. But for the company to receive state funding, it will need to continue to operate in North Carolina. The company said it intends to remain committed to the Triangle. And that was written by Mark DeRoberts. And Brad Wilson, Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina. In a year in which other health insurers pulled back from offering Affordable Care Act plans in North Carolina, Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, led by President and CEO Brad Wilson, continued. BCBSNC stayed on as the only insurer to sell ACA plans in all of North Carolina's 100 counties in 2017, but it hasn't been without challenges. As has been the case for other insurers, ACA plans have been costly for Blue Cross and Blue Shield, which has 3.8 million customers in the state. In 2015, 5% of its ACA customers costed nearly $1.3 billion, the company has said, and those customers paid premiums of just $108 million. Wilson said in October that BCBSNC filed what we believe to be an appropriate rate increase to make up that difference to keep the risk pool and market stable. The North Carolina Department of Insurance subsequently approved an average rate increase of 24.3% for BCBSNC. Those who are not eligible for a subsidy will feel out-of-pocket cost impacts because of the rising cost of health care, Wilson said, while noting the alternative would be having no choice at all. Ahead of open enrollment, BCBSNC also faced the possibility of an onslaught of about 250,000 customers from Aetna and UnitedHealthcare, for which it had not prepared. Every year we will have to ask ourselves the question, can we stay in or not, because ACA losses are unsustainable in the long term, Wilson said. It is my hope that the new administration and Congress will work together and figure out the fundamental solutions needed to make the ACA viable and sustainable into the future. President-elect Donald Trump has vowed to replace the Affordable Care Act, but it's not clear what a new alternative may look like. Wilson, who joined the company in 1995 and became CEO in 2010, will be following closely. The new year will no doubt bring major changes to health care, and Blue Cross is in a position to engage actively in discussions on how to get health care reform right for consumers, Wilson said. We must all work together to ensure the smoothest possible transition to a better, more consumer-focused health care system without jeopardizing access to health insurance and care. Rising health care costs should be at the forefront of these discussions, he said. Wilson says the U.S. must address unsustainable health care costs. Any reform that does not address the underlying cost of medical care will fail the people of North Carolina, he said. Moving forward, it's critical that our elected leaders in Washington avoid actions that create more instability in the individual insurance markets. For example, inappropriate action or inaction on addressing issues with reinsurance and risk corridor programs will undercut stability and disrupt coverage. And this was written by Jennifer Henderson. And along with this section, there's also a part of it called Looking Back, a brief update looking back at the ones we watched in 2016. Tashni Ann DeBroy, Shaw University. Tashni Ann DeBroy, who took the helm of Shaw University in 2015, continued to focus on fundraising in 2016. Following Shaw's receipt of a grant from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, DeBroy committed to matching it through working to raise $200,000. Over the summer, DeBroy announced that a 3-year salary reduction program for employees of the university would be lifted. In 2016, DeBroy was named the second most influential HBCU president by HBCU Digest. DeBroy was one of Triangle Business Journal's 40 Under 40 Leadership Award winners in 2016. Fred Eshelman, Eshelman Ventures. Fred Eshelman, who founded Wilmington-based contract research organization PPD, has moved on to new ventures since the company was taken private by affiliates of the Carlyle Group and Hellman and Friedman for $3.9 billion in 2011. While 2016 saw Eshelman continue to helm Eshelman Ventures, which invests in early-stage companies focused on healthcare, the year also saw him take a position on a big-name pharmaceutical board. Following an accounting scandal, Valeant Pharmaceuticals named a number of new members to its board in 2016, including Eshelman. Valeant has also faced problems following its acquisition of two Triangle-based companies, Salix Pharmaceuticals and Sprout. Stuart Franz, Biologics Incorporated. Biologics Incorporated's CEO, Stuart France, was a person to watch last year because of the company's rapid expansion under his watch, and the business community took notice. In April 2016, McKesson Corporation of San Francisco completed its acquisition of Carey's Biologics and of Vantage Oncology, based in Manhattan Beach, California, for a combined $1.2 billion. Both companies joined McKesson's specialty health business. This is a historic moment for our company, Fran said in a late February at the initial announcement of the acquisition. I am absolutely thrilled that our team will be joining the McKesson family, who shares our deep commitment to building a strong corporate culture focused on supporting people as individuals and providing better health. Fran is still currently leading the biologics team in Cary. Gordon Grubb, Grubb Ventures. Raleigh real estate developer Gordon Grubb hit the pause button in 2016 on his ambitious redevelopment plan for the 40-acre Glenwood Place office park, but it was still a busy year for Grubb Ventures. Grubb has started construction of the nearly $40 million Sojourn Glenwood Place apartment and retail complex at Glenwood Place. plus another upscale apartment building near Carolina Country Club. Grubb is also wrapping up the final units at the Sojourn Lake Boone apartment community on Lake Boone Trail. For Glenwood Place, Grubb has a compromise plan that will have a dense development mix of office, retail, hotel, and residential development, but will cap the building height limits to about 7 stories. Pam Heminger, Chapel Hill Mayor. Pam Heminger, a former Orange County Commissioner and Chapel Hill Carborough School Board member, upset incumbent Mayor Mark Kleinschmidt in the 2015 election. Heminger has been quickly recognizable around town, immersing herself in the history of the town and promoting charitable efforts, such as the Food for the Summer program to feed hungry children. In Chapel Hill, managing growth is always an issue. Heminger worked to make the town more friendly to development. She championed the joint county and town incentive package that landed Wegmans. The town, led by Heminger, approved incentives for Caraway Village and is looking to ensure that the Ephesus Fordham District is both walkable and an effective urban design. She also worked to update the inspections and permitting process and the sign ordinance. Fran O'Sullivan, IBM. Fran O'Sullivan, who took IBM's North Carolina reins from RTP site lead Bob Greenberg last year, remains someone we're watching. Under her leadership, IBM is embarking on an agile makeover in RTP, transforming floors that used to be dominated by opaque offices into open, collaborative workspace. Further changing up the status quo, she's pulled many remote workers back to the campus, and to those unwilling or unable to transform with Big Blue, she's wishing them well, but isn't letting them stand in the way of IBM's change trajectory. Frank Plastina, Wolfspeed. Frank Plastina was one to watch in 2016. When named with the designation, he was the newly minted CEO of Cree's power and radio frequency business, Wolfspeed. The plan, exec said at the time, was to spin Wolfspeed out into a completely separate company. In 2016, however, the plan changed when German semiconductor giant Infineon made an $850 million bid for the unit. While the deal has yet to close, Infineon execs have said they plan to keep the business in Durham. Plastina still leads Wolfspeed, and the Infineon purchase is expected to be completed in the first quarter. Margaret Spellings, UNC System. Margaret Spellings spent much of 2016 listening. She became president of the University of North Carolina System on March 1 and heard from protesters angry with the choice. She vowed to listen to their concerns and those of others as she toured all 17 campuses, asking people what made them proud, what challenges they faced, and how the UNC system could improve. Spellings had served as Secretary of Education under President George W. Bush and chaired the Spellings Commission, which recommended more engagement with the new economy and a better connection to the economic needs. David Stallings, Shenandoah Homes. David Stallings, who in 2015 acquired many of the assets of the disbanded Forever Home Building Company, spent much of 2016 getting his arms wrapped around his new investment and enacting the business plan for his new company, Shenandoah Homes. He started 2016 with ownership or control of about 1,000 housing lots in 7 communities in Wake, Durham, and Johnston counties. By the end of 2016, he expanded his reach even farther, with active projects underway in 11 communities. That included the restart of projects at the upscale The Hamptons at Umstead in West Raleigh and at Linwood Bluff, a Raleigh townhouse community. And Don Waddell, Carolina Hurricanes. Don Waddell joined the Carolina Hurricanes as president on July 1, 2014, and has put an emphasis on fan engagement. This year, PNC Arena featured $5 million in upgrades that included a new LED ribbon board. The Canes still face significant challenges. The team hasn't made the playoffs since 2009, but is making a run for the playoffs this year. Carolina remains last in the NHL in attendance by a wide margin. The Canes insist they remain committed to North Carolina, but Forbes recently ranked Raleigh as the nation's most vulnerable sports city. And now we turn to the Viewpoint page in the Triangle Business Journal and start with the editor's notebook. written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Critical Year for Local Tech Healthcare Sectors. Financial outfits that feed startups, cash-positive, and revenue-growing companies did not have a good 2016. That's because deal flow dried up substantially last year. A recent report from Ernst & Young concludes the number of initial public offerings globally in 2016 fell 16% when compared to 2015, and capital raised was down some 33% from 2015 numbers to $132 billion. Numbers get worse for the U.S., with a 36% drop in the number of IPOs year over year and a 37% drop in dollars raised. Also, mergers and acquisitions activity took a big hit last year, with a paltry amount of mega deals completed in 2016. Why do these numbers matter? They matter because capital is the subsistence for much of the growing tech, healthcare, and services companies in the Triangle and elsewhere. The Raleigh-Durham area is known for fostering disruptive technologies, advancing new drug development, and providing cost-effective services through innovation. So, when capital dries up, the pipeline and the resolve to start companies or merge entities become tougher under less favorable companies. So, yet again, we may have to rely on private equity to lead us in deal-making, very similar to 2014 when capital markets exploded and registered historic highs in dollars raised across the board. In 2016, there were only 21 tech IPOs, and the return on investment was the worst since 2003. But things started to thaw a little bit during the fourth quarter, offering hope to the financiers that exits will be more fluid in 2017. Drug development and tech companies in the Triangle looking to recapitalize might face one big question from the folks already invested in them. Where is the liquidity? That desperation to raise cash and offer exits to some investors will be the biggest reason for a IPO surge if it happens this year. And it better, the entire entrepreneurial ecosystem depends on it. If funds are not able to exit from deals with returns, they are unlikely to invest in new ventures. And that goes from angel investing to the largest private equity players in the world. Privco, a private company financial intelligence research firm, identified 130 companies across the world primed for an IPO in 2017, including some big names such as Uber, Dropbox, and Airbnb. Not surprisingly, there weren't any Triangle companies on the list. And in CB Insights' 2017 tech pipeline forecast of companies most likely to hit the public markets, North Carolina was not even mentioned among the top 13 states. Yikes. But that's okay. If activity starts to pick up, investors start searching for hidden value deals, and that's where we may start to see local activity. And also on the Viewpoint page, we have a column written by Matthew M. Chingos, who is a senior fellow at the Urban Institute. Also assisting with the report was Kristen Blagg, a research associate at the Urban Institute. The headline, Making Sense of Complex College Return on Investment Formula. State and federal policymakers have embraced the idea that prospective college students need better information on earnings outcomes for individual colleges and programs of study. One of the Obama administration's signature higher education policy efforts was the new College Scorecard, which provides information on median income after attending a given college. And several states have developed data systems that allow students to obtain this information for individual programs, such as the average earnings of business majors at a particular college. These efforts are premised on the notion that better data will push institutions to compete in ways that increase quality and lower costs. But will they work in practice? There are some reasons for skepticism. It is difficult to compare the outcomes of colleges and programs that enroll students with widely varying characteristics, especially academic preparation. Further, there is little agreement on how to combine or synthesize different outcome measures. These are both reasons the Obama administration abandoned its original plan for ratings and replaced it with a scorecard. But even if the measures were perfect, the potential for consumer information to change student decision-making may still be constrained by the fact that many students only consider institutions near where they live due to a desire or need to remain close to home, i.e. due to work or family obligations. In a new report released recently, we empirically document the extent to which earnings data are likely to be useful to potential students who are comparing different institutions that offer the same program, e.g. bachelor's degree in business at Virginia Tech versus at University of Virginia. We find that only 36% of Virginia high school seniors are likely to be able to use program-level earnings data to make a meaningful distinction between programs of study at two or more institutions. The reason is that students' college choices are constrained by their academic credentials and geographic location, as well as by their personal career interests. This is especially true for students only considering community colleges near where they live, of which only 4% can use earnings data to compare programs across colleges. Comparing outcomes across institutions offering the same program is only one possible use of earnings data. Other possible uses include choosing among majors at a given institution, or deciding whether to go to college at all, especially for students who only have one realistic option, such as the local community college. But for potential use, earnings data will only impact decision-making if students care about those data and can access and make sense of them. For example, how should a student compare two programs with average earnings among graduates of $45,000 versus $50,000? But at institutions that have graduation rates of 70% versus 50%. And that's if students can even find the data in the first place, as they are often buried in government websites and efforts to make them more accessible often fall short. Three recently developed online tools, GradPath VA, MyFuture TX, and MyFuture Texas and Launch My Career Colorado, highlight the trade-offs inherent in trying to bring program-level earnings data to life for potential students. GradPath Virginia, a website that allows students to easily compare graduates' earnings for a given major at different institutions. MyFuture Texas, produced by the research group College Measures, allows Texas students to start from a preferred career, college, or major. Launch My Career Colorado is another College Measures website that provides a more graphical walkthrough format. Once students have settled on a given college and a given major, it produces a return on investment calculation, customizable for a student's lifestyle goal. This additional detail comes at the cost of making it more difficult to compare the same program across different institutions. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the People on the Move section, where the spotlight is on Rahul Kumar, VP of Revenue at Translok. Rahul Kumar has spent his entire career in the public transportation arena, mostly in the Southern California area, and for the past 2 years in Paris. Now he's back in the States and is employed by Durham-based Translok, a technology company that works to create smart app technologies that service transit agencies. The products aim to make public transportation easier by connecting people to transit schedules. As Vice President of Revenue at Translok, Kumar is charged with managing the overall growth of the company, with sales, customer service, and strategy and partnerships falling under the revenue team umbrella. Currently, Translok employs 76 full-time staffers and is helmed by its CEO, Doug Kaufman. In March 2016, the company scored $8 million in funding. What's one thing you wish people knew about your job? How promoting great culture and investing in people doesn't necessarily mean a loss in profit. At Translok, we believe that by creating a culture that supports people and gives them a great place to work, it will result in our company's growth and success. What are some of your major goals for your position? Growth, growth, growth. My responsibilities are to build on what the company has already done in the past 12 years and branch out new products and revenue streams. But the difference about Translok versus other companies is that we work with our clients from the inside out as opposed to working from the top down. Biggest pet peeve? the wardrobe. It's been a long time since I have worked in an environment that doesn't require me to wear a suit and tie each day, but I can get over this pet peeve pretty quickly. Biggest worry? As with any other technology-driven company, we must always be striving to innovate new products and solutions for fear of being overtaken by a competitor. Family? Kumar and his wife have two daughters. Next in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Biz column, a quick glance at Triangle happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. The main headline, he'd love to double convention space. Doug Grissom's office in the Raleigh Convention Center looks over Red Hat Amphitheater, and perhaps there's a reason for that. Grissom, who took over as director of the Raleigh Convention Center last summer, has big plans for the convention center. In fact, he'd like to double it. We'd like to expand, Grissom tells Biz. We need more space. Right now, the RCC, which opened in 2008, has 500,000 square feet. The center is essentially booked all year, Grissom says, except for a few weeks in June and July. In a fiscal year that begins July 1, Grissom expects the RCC to have more than 270 events and attract between 400,000 and 440,000 people. He expects to match or exceed that in the fiscal year that begins July 1, even though House Bill 2 has been a damper. Part of how the convention center has responded, he says, is looking across the state to urge people to keep business here. Still, Grissom believes more is possible in the future. We're turning away business, he says. Grissom would love to add a building just as large as the current convention center, probably on the land currently holding the amphitheater, which would be relocated. I think we could support something about as big as this building, he says. The Red Hat space was originally meant to be temporary anyway, and it has been a success. Red Hat held 39 events in 2016 and 122,000 people. Grissom expects roughly the same number in 2017. Expanding would require millions of dollars and approvals at multiple levels, but Grissom believes there could be movement in the coming years. If it's going to happen, it'd happen by 2020 or 2022, he says. The demand is there, Grissom says. Colorado Microbrew comes to Raleigh. More suds are headed for the Triangle. Centennial, Colorado-based microbrew pub and restaurant chain Growler USA has committed to opening a location at 314 South Blunt Street in downtown Raleigh, just across from City Market. Local franchise owners Amrish Raj and Sunita McCoy are behind the downtown Raleigh venture. Typically, the locations feature up to 100 taps of craft beer, hard cider, drought wine, cold-pressed coffee, and kombucha tea, with a heavy emphasis on local and regional beers. Growlers will be available for take-home purchase. The menu features a variety of salads, sandwiches, pizzas, and other quick bites. This isn't the company's first foray in North Carolina, and plans are to open a few more in the state. Growler USA opened its second location and first franchise in Charlotte a year ago. The man behind the Queen City franchise, Matt Coben, will also be opening one in Gastonia in March. Future locations in the Tar Heel State are also planned for Durham and Wilmington, but further location specifics haven't been made public yet. In less than a year, the national chain has gone from one location to 10, with another 30 location agreements in place. It has locations in Georgia, Florida, Texas, Arizona, and Washington. Media merger. A local communications company, led by some former Triangle television personalities, is merging with Walk West, based on NC State University's Centennial Campus. Green Room Communications, whose leadership included the Holderness couple, known for the Christmas Jammies video, will join the Walk West team that has grown to more than 30 members. Green Room's Sharon Delaney McLeod, a former WNCN TV anchor, will become a partner at Walk West. Penn and Kim Holderness will serve as the company's advisors. Seven other Green Room employees will join Walk West. Walk West CEO Brian Honorio, who started the company in 2007, says the energy between the two groups was electric. The marriage of Walk West and Green Room felt natural from the start, he says. The goal is to connect WalkWest's digital expertise with the video capacities of Green Room. Publix coming to Durham, perhaps. A recent announcement by the Publix supermarket chain that it is planning to open a new store in North Durham has many of the property's neighbors crying foul. The development proposal at the corner of Latta and Guest Roads is still under review by Durham City County planning staff. A rezoning request for the property is expected to be considered by the Planning Commission in February. David Parker, a resident of the Lock Haven Hills community, says many of the nearby residents are most concerned with the level of commercial development that is being proposed because the property is about 2,000 feet from the banks of the Eno River, as well as the increased traffic a new retail center could bring. Apple to launch bigger store at Crabtree Valley Mall. The go-to shop at Crabtree Valley Mall for all things Apple is about to get a complete makeover and nearly double in size. A Crabtree official confirms that the mall's Apple store will move from its current 5,500 square foot shop space to a new home with close to 9,000 square feet of showroom floor, making it among the largest Apple stores in the region. Apple also has a dedicated shop at the streets at South Point Mall in Durham, but appointment openings for Genius Bar training or assistance at either store can sometimes take 2 weeks or more. The expanded Apple store in Raleigh is expected to be open by November. And now we turn to the Executive Voice column that features Red Eye Worldwide. The headline, Company Passionate About Music is at Home in Hillsboro. This is written by Amanda Hoyle. Glenn Dicker and Tor Hansen have known each other since grade school growing up in the Philadelphia suburb of Doylestown, Pennsylvania, but it wasn't until they were in junior high and discovered their mutual interest in music that they became best friends for life. Dicker and Hansen even started their own band together, which broke up and was reunited after Hansen finished his studies in business at Westchester University, and Dicker from Gettysburg College with a degree in sociology. The band they formed, The Vouts, released a few singles and an album, but music success eluded the duo. Dicker relocated to Boston to take a job with Rounder Records, followed by Hansen a few years later, where both found success in helping other bands promote and sell their music. Several years later, in 1996, Dicker and Hansen decided it was time they launched their own music distribution company, and what is known as Red Eye Worldwide was born. The company started out of Hansen's kitchen in Carrboro and then a warehouse in Haw River until relocating in 2016 to a 90,000-square-foot building in Hillsboro. Here, Dicker discusses the company's growth and the reason for landing in Hillsboro. How did the two of you meet and become friends? We were neighbors. We went to the same school and bonded mostly around music. We were in junior high talent shows doing Beatles songs the first time and the second time doing The Who and other 60s band covers. In high school, we started writing songs and playing parties, gigs, etc. We played in bands together throughout school and then we moved to Boston in 1988. What kind of music did your bands play? We were in many bands together, but the most serious of them was kind of hyper, psych-infused garage pop thing. Explain what Red Eye's role is in the distribution and marketing of product in the industry. What services do you provide? Primarily, Red Eye, as a distribution company, is responsible for getting music into the marketplace, following on the demand created by artists and their record labels, marketing, and promotion efforts. That means we put records into shops, online retailers, digital service providers, etc. From the indie record stores, such as School Kids Records, to larger chains, such as Barnes & Noble, to Amazon, iTunes, Apple Music, Spotify, Pandora, etc. The music industry is becoming much more fragmented. How do you help keep Red Eye relevant? We have worked hard to have relationships at every level of the music consumption chain. These relationships enable us to provide the distribution services that our exclusive label relationships require to get their music to market. Why did you decide to move the company to a bigger building in Hillsboro? We moved our record label, Yep Rock Records, to Hillsboro about 5 years ago to Churton Street. The town and Orange County in general were more than welcoming to us. Through some great relationships that we developed with folks such as Steve Brantley, the Orange County Economic Development Director, we were able to identify a space that would fit our needs for the long haul and enable us to thrive. The Triangle is not known as a hotbed for the entertainment industry. Why have you decided to keep Red Eye based here? The Triangle has always been a great area for music and home to a handful of great labels over the years, such as Merge Records and Mammoth Records, for example. When Red Eye was getting started, there were loads of great bands in the Southeast in general, and no real organization to help them get their music into the marketplace beyond a handful of independent labels. Red Eye saw the opportunity to help these artists expand their ability to get music to fans beyond that of selling their records at a local record store via consignment and selling off the stage. Hansen has relocated to Berlin. What series of events led to that decision? Red Eye saw the need to expand our international services to better serve the needs of our customers and our label partners. We needed to be able to provide a one point of contact solution for the many labels we distribute so that they could easily and professionally get their music to market on a worldwide basis. Tor moved to Berlin to work directly with our expanding international team to better serve our label partners and customers. In addition to our Berlin office, we also have offices in London, Toronto, and Sydney. What has been your biggest challenge in your career thus far? Early on, it was cash flow management. As we were a completely independently owned venture with no capital invested in the company, we had to take a very patient approach to growth due to limited cash flow. There are all the normal challenges of a startup to contend with, but also having limited cash flow was a very tricky matter. As we grew, we continued to invest all of the profit back into the growth of the company, and we are still growing in this way today. Slow and patient growth matched with an aggressive focus on maximizing opportunities in the market. And along with this article, there's a closer look, a box of information, name, Glenn Dicker and Tor Hansen, title, Co-Founders and Owners of Red Eye Worldwide, Business, Distribution and Sales of Music by Independent Music Labels and Artists to Digital and Physical Outlets Around the World, Location, Hillsboro, Number of Employees, close to 70, What was your very first job growing up? Dicker, washing dishes in a bakery and mowing lawns. Tor, it was a paper route. And I think we're going to stop there. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.